Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is Denny Lyon, who will be reaching back in history to tell us about some of DC's favorite old bars. Well, welcome to the show, Denny.
Well, thank you, Art. I'm happy to be here. I'm glad that somebody cares about this kind of stuff, quite frankly, because it was a golden age of bars, and I don't want it to be forgotten.
I agree. I think so much of our history has been recorded as far as protests and riots and politicians and legislation, and the bars, which were so important to making us a community and giving us friends and support and you know, chosen family, have been ignored. So,
well, you know, it was our safe spaces, let's face it. I mean, because where else did we have to go to meet people, you know, of like orientation? We didn't. I mean, some people, you know, just were happy meeting people on the streets, you know, or, you know, cruising late at night in their car. But, you know, that's only so much. I mean, you need to be able to talk to people and relate to people. And I think that's what the bars provided. They provided that social interaction that so many people didn't have and needed just to feel like their life was worth something. So,
absolutely. Yeah. And you have a long history working in the gay bar scene in the DC area. One of the bars I know you worked at is a personal favorite of mine. I went there a long, long time ago, and that was Lost and Found. What was your position at Lost and Found?
Well, I started there. It was very serendipitous because I hadn't planned on going to work there, but I was living in DC. I had recently gotten out of the Navy, and I had a temporary government job, and the job ended, and the person I was renting a flat from in his house turned out to be the primary owner of the Lost and Found. Who I knew he was because I'd met him through a mutual family friend, and which is how I came to be renting the flat. And we became very good friends and very close. We spent a lot of time together. I told him that I was out of work and I was looking, and he said to me, "Why don't you come and wait tables at Lost and Found?" And I said, "Well, I've never waited tables." And he said, "Well, that's okay. We can teach you the nuts and bolts. You just have an outgoing personality, and you make friends easily. So, you know, you've got half the battle won there." So I went and did that, and that's how I got in working at the Lost and Found. That was in September of 73.
And what was it? What was his name? What was the owner's name?
His name was Don Culver. He unfortunately passed away in 93, a very bizarre accident at the club, in fact. But at any rate, so I started.
Was that the banner hanging accident?
Say again?
It has to do with hanging a banner.
He was hanging, actually, he was covering part of the outside deck with a parachute. And he was on the roof of an adjoining building, you know, fastening it down, and the wind caught it and whipped it around him and flung him across the deck. And it broke his back, broke his neck, gave him a severe concussion from which he did not recover. It was really bizarre. It was really incredibly emotionally depressing, obviously. Because I wasn't actually working there at the time. I had gone away and was doing something else. But we still maintained our friendship, and we're very close. And I was going back there to help him out because that was the weekend of the March on Washington, the 93 March on Washington. And he was getting ready to have a busy weekend, and he needed extra staff. And he asked me to come help him out. And the reason he was putting the parachute up was that the club was booked that night for a party by one of the outside groups. I can't remember who it was, and they were having a large event there. and he thought it would be great to have that covering up on the deck to, you know, just make it more you know, amenable to a large group. At any rate, so.
So did the event go on anyway? Did the bar continue to operate that weekend?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. It went on like nothing happened. And it was probably one of the busiest nights the place had ever seen. And I can remember distinctly standing in the dining room. Did you ever go there after they put up the glass wall to separate the dining room from the dance bar?
Yes.
Okay. We were standing. I was standing with his partner at the time. And we were standing in there looking out at the crowd. And at that right then, we got a phone call from the hospital where he had been taken, which was DC General Hospital, which is a terrible hospital. And they had said that he had passed away. And we're standing there looking at the club and it's busiest night probably ever. And we broke out a bottle of Tattinger's, and which was his favorite Blanc Noir. And we toasted him. And of course, broke down and cried, but then went on with the evening as if nothing had happened, because that's what he would want. I mean, the show must go on. He was of all things, he was a theatrical person. And early on in his life, he had gone to Hollywood and tried to get in the movies, which he was not successful with, but he tried at least. And had a lot of friends from that time. So that was Don Culver, and I think he was in one of the pictures I sent you. There was most of the pictures I sent you were a bunch of people in tuxedos, and that was the 10th anniversary celebration of the Lost and Found. He was notorious. The Lost and Found was notorious for having anniversary celebrations, you know, every year of on their anniversary, obviously. And they were like really incredibly opulent spreads of food and open bar and anything you wanted, and come in and have a great time, because they had done very well and they wanted to give back. And that's how they gave back. In addition, we did a lot of fundraising for charities as well.
You had been to the bar before you started working there, correct?
Oh yeah. And I knew Don before I started living with him, because he had, prior to the Lost and Found, he and his partner at the Lost and Found, Bill Bickford, had worked at another bar over on 8th Street near the Marine Barracks called the Plus One. And they left the Plus One when the main investor decided he could do a better job, and he forced them out. And that's when they decided to do the Lost and Found. And they got, you know, money from various people that they had met while they were at the Plus One, and invested it and purchased a property down in Southeast, which is where the club was. It was the old Senate Laundry. And not for the Senate, but that's just the name of it. And it was a big old sprawling building, as I'm sure you remember.
But
it was perfect for what they did with it. I've been there. I mean, I've been there because I was back in Washington before I lost my government job. And, you know, that's where I went on the weekends. I would like, just like everybody else. Down in Southeast.
What was your first impression when you walked into Lost and Found for the first time?
Well, I was just amazed. I mean, it was so big. I mean, you went in the front door, and he was really good about doing the. He redid the same thing, made it so when you came in the front door, you could only see a little bit. You couldn't see the whole place. And as you walked past where you had your ID check or paid the cover or whatever it was, then the club would open up to you and you would be amazed. And it worked really well. And I was totally amazed when I first went in there, because it was so big and it was so nice. I mean, that was the thing I think most people remember it for. It was really nice. I mean, it was very tasteful. It was very well done. It was very clean. And it was just very warm and welcoming. And so, yeah, that was my first impression pretty much. That it was just, I mean, where has this been all my life? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I remember it being a big, grand, fancy place. Always busy on the weekends. I don't think I was ever there during the week, but I posted something in our Facebook group today, the Gabe Archives Facebook group, asking for people about memories of the lost and found. And one member, Jeff Brown, posted a comment that said, "My husband and I spent a fair amount of time there, usually with our friends. Their restaurant was good too." And that was kind of a surprising comment, because so many times you hear about gay bars that serve food and it's like the worst food on the planet, but there it wasn't the case.
No, well, Don had decided that if he was going to, because at the time to serve booze in the district, you had to serve food. There was no tavern license or thing like that. You had to serve food, and you had to be able to prove that 50% of your income was from food, which was really a high bar to meet. But so he decided he was going to do it and do it right. And so he always hired chefs who had a good reputation. In fact, there was a couple of chefs that I worked with there who were CIA trained, you know, so that they knew what the hell they were doing. They could whip up anything you wanted and make it taste good and look good. And so he had decided that it would be really a good thing to do, because nobody had that. You know, people, especially if they were having a celebratory thing, they would go to some restaurant, but they wouldn't feel comfortable about, you know, maybe, you know, being with their partner or, you know, showing any modicum of affection in a celebratory place. But here you could do that. And, you know, and nobody would bat an eye, obviously. So I, you know, that was part of his whole plan for doing the place. And, you know, God bless his soul for having that kind of thought. It was lovely, and the food was excellent.
To put it in perspective, you're talking about a time period that's just a few years after Stonewall. You know, you're talking about something that opened in the 70s. And right. It wasn't, you know, like it is today, where you could probably take your date to, I don't know, Applebee's or Chili's and get away with it. Back then, it was a big deal. I mean, people looked at you cross-eyed if you were a group of four or five men having dinner together just as friends, because, yep. Like, what's going on here? Men don't go out to dinner together.
Yep. And you're totally right about that. It was something that had not happened in the past, or was not happening at the time. So it really was an important thing at the time.
How long did the bar last after his accident? Did they close shortly thereafter, or did they stay open for a while?
Stayed open for a while. In fact, his partner, who was still involved, asked me to come back and help out for a little bit, which I did for a couple of years until I actually went on to another job with another company. It stayed open for a while, and there was a time when we had tried to, you know, rebrand it a little bit, which never worked out. That was you saw the business cards I sent you, Quorum. And then it finally, after a while, it just became not financially viable, because, you know, times had changed and people had moved on, and there was other bars that were opening in areas that were a little bit more user friendly, so to speak. I mean, because I'm sure you remember that it was down in the Warehouse District, which I think when it first opened was a plus, because people couldn't be worried about being seen going into the place, because anybody who was down there was going into the place.
Right.
So I, you know, that was a plus. But then by the time the 80s showed up, there were like little neighborhood bars that were popular, and they were up in like in the DuPont Circle area, which became the first gayborhood in D.C. That sort of signaled the end of the road for the lost and found, because there was just really it still had happened on the weekends, not during the week at all, and at the time they absolutely refused to close Monday through Thursday, even though there was no business. There would be nights when maybe 20 people would walk through the front door, which, if you remember the place, that's a large place to have only 20 people in it.
Absolutely. It was a gigantic club. And I remember fondly having, many, many great experiences there. It was kind of, in my opinion, it was kind of the same kind of vibe and feeling as Trax had when Trax was in DC, high as far as the dance and drink part of it, very high, kind of high energy, fun, packed place with a big dance floor. And so it was kind of sad. And so many of those places, that whole Southeast area of DC, everything is gone as far as the gay bars are concerned, because it's the park for the Nationals now, isn't it?
Well, everything that was ever there is gone.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all new construction. Where the Lost and Found was is now a condo. And on the other side of the block is I believe it's a Marriott, one of their off brands. And then there's another part that's an office building. And they just recently took down the building that the pier was in, which had become Ziegfeld Secrets. Because that whole area got changed because they built the soccer stadium across the street from where it was. So the whole neighborhood just immediately was totally transformed, and old buildings just, the property value was worth more than the business and the rent. So the owners, sold it, obviously, and it got knocked down, and I'm sure they're putting up, I have no idea what they're putting up there now. I haven't been down there. I have kind of avoided going down there because I just didn't want to be any more depressed about the whole thing.
And you mentioned the pier, and you also worked there, correct?
Yeah. Well, see, very shortly after I went to work at the Lost and Found, Don's company bought the pier. Because the pier preceded the Lost and Found by about a year and a half, I believe. And it was doing really well, except that it got in financial difficulties. And the people who were running it just were running out of funds to keep it going. And so they bought it and started running it at that point in time. And that was roughly 74, probably 74. And it was 77 when we did the big remodel of the place, which was a huge undertaking, to say the least, because there was a lot of stuff that needed to be fixed and stuff. So at any rate, yeah. So, yeah. And so I went to help out with that. At one point I had been in the management team at Lost and Found, and I was a kind of person who could take projects and do things. I still am kind of, I'm a big organizational freak. So I got involved with doing that, and he made me director of operations for the company to oversee that and the Lost and Found as well. So, I was involved in both of them at the time. And it was what a time it was. I mean, you spend the weekend, they were like six blocks apart, maybe. But, driving between the two of them, of course, was necessary because the neighborhood was still, you don't walk around in it kind of neighborhood. Right. So you would drive down from one to the other, and you spend a half hour looking for a place to park, easily a half hour, if not more. And both of them would be majorly packed with people. And it was just, an amazing time to be in the business, quite frankly.
Now, am I correct? In doing my research on these bars in D.C., I kept stumbling across the name Pier 9. Was that the original name for the pier? Or was it?
Yes, it was, originally was the Pier 9.
And then they changed to the pier.
They just dropped the 9 and then changed the logo from the one that you had that looked like a male sex symbol to the one that is just the name, and put up a big sign out front with that on it. It was one of the first bars with a sign. I mean, because the Lost and Found didn't have a sign. It had a little piece of artwork which sort of represented the logo, but it did not say Lost and Found anywhere on the outside of the building.
As was the case with so many bars back then.
Oh, yeah.
Gay bars, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, so many gay bars at that time were painted in a black or gray or just some bland color, and you would either have to enter through an alley or a back door. There was no sign, or if there was a sign, it was very discreet. It was a little tiny, you know, nothing.
Yep. And a lot of the bars back before that were actually bars that had been straight, that had become gay, and were, you know, and they never put any kind of signage out or rainbow flags out. I don't even think the rainbow flag was around then.
No, it wasn't.
And so, yeah, there was just, you know, it was a whole different time.
A lot of people who have been to D.C. and partied in D.C. who are, you know, over 50 or 60 remember Lost and Found and remember a few of the other bars. But I've spoken to several of them who somehow missed out on ever visiting or hearing about the pier. And I wanted to point out that, if I'm not mistaken, the pier had a fantastic sound system.
Yes, it had a fantastic sound system. And when we redid it, we put it in an all-new light show, and we installed a laser light show. It was the first in the country in a dance bar and in a club. And it became very notorious for that. In fact, the Washington Post did a front page of the style section article on the pier after it got redone. And that was kind of the beginning of the end of it being strictly a gay bar, because then it became very fashionable for the straight people to go to.
About what time frame was this?
Well, this was in the, redo is in 77. So we're talking 77, 78, late 70s.
Yeah.
And it became a very mixed club at that point in time. I mean, it still was, you know, I mean, a lot of gay people went there, and you still could hold hands and do that kind of shit and do same-sex dancing. But there was a lot of straight people there as well. And for a lot of gay people, that put people off. So I think that kind of like kept feeding the Lost and Found a little bit. But then there was other things that popped up around it. So, the whole area, of course, then Tracks showed up, which was across the street from the Lost and Found. The building that Tracks was in had originally been an auto dealership, and then it had become a distribution center for the Evening Star newspaper before the people from Denver bought the property and turned it into Tracks. And when Tracks opened, it really hurt the Lost and Found quite a bit. Business-wise, but it made the whole area a little bit more club-friendly at night, especially on the weekends. There was a lot of back and forth between the two locations. So it was probably the first nail in the coffin for the Lost and Found. But I think, as you probably are well aware, the one of the biggest nails in the coffin was the AIDS epidemic, which just really tore through everything. I mean, you know, that one picture I sent you of all the people, that was the entire staff of the Lost and Found at the 10th anniversary party. And I think most of those people, if I can go through and I can remember most of them, I remember most of their names, they did not survive the AIDS epidemic. And of course, that was reflected in the clientele as well, in that there were people that I knew that went there all the time, that all of a sudden they weren't there all the time. And it was a really sad time. And it, as you well know, kept on until the 90s, being a big scourge.
Now you were director of operations for the company at the time when the remodel was done at the Pier, correct?
Yep.
So the rumors I've heard from the articles I've found online, information I've been able to uncover, said that the sound system that went into the place when you remodeled it was valued at $250,000 in the late 70s. Is that about right? Does that sound reasonable to you?
No, it doesn't. I think that's just an inflated price. I mean, a lot of the stuff was custom made for the location and for the shape of the room, because, you know, you have to think about that, the shape of the room when you put a sound system in. And a lot of it was, you know, it wasn't like all of a sudden one fell swoop sound system. Stuff was added on later on. Don was very big in finding, you know, really clean and precise and crisp sound in addition to the thumping beat. So he got involved with a kind of speaker, which I didn't even know if they're still making it anymore, called the Heil, H-E-I-L, air motion treble system, which was a whole bunch of little vanes that looked like they were all like little pieces of shiny silver. And for some reason they worked, and they just made the sound all that much cleaner and clearer and amazing. So that may be what led to the thing. $500,000 was no, we did not have that kind of money, quite frankly, to do anything like that. But, you know, it may have seemed that way to people, but that's a lot. Was a little unrealistic.
So you'll be happy to know that Heil is still actually in business, and they still are considered leaders in the sound system industry. So he had a good foresight to pick something out 45 years ago that, you know, that was of a quality that was, you know, representative of what he was trying to do.
I'm glad to know that. And in fact, before he put them, and he put them in the Lost and Found as well, he had them personally at his own apartment. So, you know, he was a big, and he had built them into the apartment and built big speaker screens so they looked bigger than they actually were. You know, a little bit of smoke and mirrors kind of thing.
Right.
Which was part of the thing at the Pier as well, making it look bigger than it was, just because it, you know, for the, you know, the sheer production value. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that Heil's still out there. I did not know that. It's not something that I've kept up with, quite frankly.
Now, between the two bars, they were in close proximity. They were both owned by the same company. They both catered to the gay clientele. They both had dance floors and light shows and sound systems. What was the difference between the clientele of the two?
Well, actually, it became less of a difference as time wore on, because once people discovered the Pier, then they also discovered the Lost and Found. And, you know, and so there would be a lot of like straight people on the weekend that the gay people would get upset about. But the problem was, and we had the same situation at Nellie's when I was there, is that, you know, the gay boys would bring their girlfriends, their straight girlfriends, and have a wonderful time. And then the straight girlfriends would bring their straight boyfriends. And so it was, you know, it just was, you know, a curse that kept reinforcing itself. So, you know, towards the end of time, the clientele was not that, that much difference. It's just that the Lost and Found was more of a diversified space. It had more stuff going on. The Pier was just strictly a huge, big dance club. In fact, the second floor, which we redid to some extent, it was just more dance floor, and that's all it was. That's the pier was a dance club strictly. You know, if you wanted to sit and talk with somebody, that was not the place to do it. Although people did do it, there were nooks and crannies that you could find. But you know, the Lost and Found had a lot more diverse areas. I'm sure you remember there was the upstairs bar, originally called the Attic, which was much quieter, which later on became wet. And then there was the outside deck, which of course was a quieter area. And you know, on the other side of the deck, there was the Way Off Broadway Cabaret Theater, which I also ran for a little bit of time, you know, producing shows over there. Way Off Broadway was originally built to do drag shows, but recurring drag shows were not revenue producers back then, not like they are now. I mean, virtually every place you look is doing a drag brunch sometime during the week. I'm sure it's the same way down there as it is up here. It's gotten ridiculous. I mean, I didn't know there were that many drag queens around. Obviously there are. So it was originally going to be a for drag shows. That was not self-sustaining. So that Don at that point in time had a friend who was a producer of sorts, who he installed as the producer of doing shows at the Way Off Broadway. And it ended up being a cabaret theater and you know, and showcasing a whole lot of people that became very famous. I mean, Barbara Cook played there. Peter Allen played there. Waylon Flowers and Madden played there. Lynn Carter, great female impersonator from P-Town who had the Pilgrim House, played there. A lot of people played there, and of course it was infamous for the gay group Gotham from New York City, who was a surefire sellout. We put them on for 8 weeks at a time and sell out every damn show. So you know, it was a more diversified situation down there than it was at the pier.
Now, after you left Lost and Found in the pier, how long was it before you went to Nellie's?
Oh, it was quite a bit of time. I mean, I left there in the early 90s, and I went and did a whole bunch of different things in between. One of the first things I did afterwards was a pizza joint up in what is now the U Street Adams Morgan area called Julio's Rooftop Pizza. And it just serendipitously had a very large gay crowd. It was a very fun place. It would serve really good food and was really noted for the brunches on Saturdays and Sundays.
I remember that. I went to visit D.C. at one point, and you may have been working there at Julio's. I had gone to visit some friends. I think it was Valentine's weekend or something. It was around Valentine's Day. And I was staying with a friend of mine in Roslyn, Virginia, and he wanted to go to brunch on Sunday, and so we went there, and he said his husband was going to meet us there, and I had not met his husband at that point, and his husband joined us at Julio's for Sunday brunch, which was amazing.
It was huge. It was huge.
I was completely embarrassed because his husband was Steve Gunderson.
Was who?
Steve Gunderson. He was a U.S. representative from Wisconsin.
Yes.
And Rob Morris was my friend, the architect who worked in historic preservation in D.C. So we had gone there. It was a great time. The dinner was the lunch brunch was awesome. You know, the rooftop views were really cool. It was a great place. I don't know if it was supposed to be gay, but it seemed like it when we were there.
Oh, it was very mixed. It was very mixed all the time. In fact, I think one of the reasons I got hired to run the place, and I was hired in as general manager, and I was taking over from one of the investor's sons who had no business running it because he had no experience and he was not doing a very good job of it. At any rate, I think part of the reason that they hired me was because of my past experience with the Lost and Found of the Pier, because I think they wanted to make the gay clientele more comfortable. And it was just north of DuPont Circle, of course. So it was very close to the gayborhood. And it still is, although it's not Julio's anymore. So I was there for like 4 years.
Well, it was a great experience. So
it was a lot of fun.
So how did you end up going to Nelly's? Did they contact you, or did you already know the owners?
Well, that's another long, long story. I mean, to get from Julio's to Nelly's, that we're talking 20 years. Okay. So I did other things in the 20 years. But the thing I was doing right before Nelly's is I had one point in time, I decided I needed to figure out something to do when I didn't want to work in restaurants anymore, but it's something, you know, something that was sort of connected to it. So I went to work for Micros POS Systems, which was headquartered in Columbia, Maryland, which is sort of halfway between Washington and Baltimore. And I went to work there, you know, to sell POS systems and to service the clientele that already had the systems, making sure that they had the maintenance they had. And it turned out it was something that I absolutely hated doing. I was not real good at driving around in my car and trying to convince people that ran little faux shops that they should have a POS system, because they were more than happy to use the cigar box. So the guy I went to work for, who is still a very good friend to this day, knew I wasn't very happy. And he had people that he knew that were part owners in Nelly's. And they had expressed to him that they were looking for somebody to come and take over the place, because it just wasn't really that well run and stuff like that. And he recommended me, and I interviewed, and I got the job. So that's how I got into Nelly's. And he was totally right that the owner of Nelly's, who I think you probably have heard of, Doug Shands, had never been in the restaurant business or bar business before. He just thought it'd be a great idea, and he had this great location, and it was, and still is, a great location. And so the person he hired in as general manager was a personal friend of his who had no restaurant experience either. So, you know, I don't care what your clientele is, but you got to know how to run a restaurant and a bar and do that kind of, you know, nuts and bolts kind of thing if you're going to be successful. And they were successful. They were making money, but they didn't know how they were making money, and it wasn't properly staffed. And they weren't doing any inventories or anything like that, or running it the way it needed to run, you know. And in between the times in between Julio's and Nelly's, I had worked for a variety of restaurant companies, and also for a little bit of time for Marriott Corporation. So I had learned about all the nuts and bolts and the P&L things and all the ways you needed to watch your money so that you knew that you were making money or not. And so I got all those things in there, and it was making money, and it started making more money. And we started doing a lot of really good promotions, which really, really increased the business. I mean, one thing that was happening at Nelly's when I got there is that they were having drag brunch on Sunday. On Saturday, they just had brunch, and it just was brunch, you know, just, it was pretty much the same food spread that they had on Sundays, but there was no entertainment. It was just come in and have something to eat and blah, 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 and go. And it was incredibly not successful. I mean, you know, just nobody showed up. I mean, some of the neighborhood people did, because it was one of the few options they had at the time. And at one point in time, I said to Doug, I said, well, why aren't we doing drag brunch on Saturdays just like you were doing on Sundays? And he was very hesitant at first, because he said, didn't want to become known as the drag place. And well, he finally gave in, and we did it. And of course it was an overnight success, or an over weekend success or whatever. And then it led to doing some other things, you know, like drag karaoke and drag bingo and stuff like that. So, you know, that's, kind of how things went with Nellie's.
Now, I remember when I first heard about Nellie's, as I recall, it was billed originally as a sports bar.
Yes, it still is.
And I remember when I first heard the name, I thought, this is somebody's twisted joke about, you know, a sports bar named after some sissy kind of guy or something. But I couldn't find out the name has nothing to do with being gay. Nellie was the owner's grandmother. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct.
And somewhere in the bar, there's actually a picture of Nellie.
There's two very large portraits in the bar, on the downstairs bar, when you first come in. Very large pictures. So, you know, you know, it was one of the fun things to do to disabuse people of the reason for the name. And, you know, and that's what I thought, why I thought it was called Nellie's to begin with myself when I first stumbled upon the place before I went to work there. I'm not sure people really know that anymore, or if it matters to anybody anymore about how it got its name.
Well, hopefully if they watch the video, they'll know. Now, Nellie's as a sports bar is a completely different concept than what you had going on with the dance bars that you worked at and, you know, the mega clubs and whatever. But it is kind of distinctive because it sits on a street corner, doesn't it? And it's right open to traffic. I mean, there's no mistaking that that's a gay bar when you drive or walk by.
Oh, no, there's a gay flag flying. There are three flagpoles from the roof, one of which is the American flag, and one of which is DC's flag, and one of which is the rainbow flag. So there's no doubting what it is at all at this point in time.
I've seen what they do when they decorate for holidays or parades, pride parades or whatever. I mean, that building explodes with rainbows. Now, what's the inside like?
When I went to work there, they still had the tent on the roof, which was great for when the weather was decent, but it was terrible in the late fall, in winter and early spring, when there was a lot of precipitation and it was cold out, and it wore out. I mean, it developed big holes that couldn't be patched and stuff like that. So eventually we sort of hardened it. We hardened the rooftop, but put in large custom made windows that could be open so it could mimic the outside, and there were skylights and everything. So that happened while I was there. And there were people, there were diehards in the beginning that said, oh, you're ruining the rooftop. Well, we said, no, we're making the rooftop year round, which it did. And it was worth the expense because it did make the rooftop year round. And people, you know, would come for the rooftop, and that actually ended up being turning into a dance bar itself, the rooftop. I'm sure they still do. I don't know. I haven't been there in some time. Had DJs and would have large dance parties and did tea dances on Sundays and stuff like that. So, yeah.
Now, I assume their menu was more what you would consider bar food type menu.
Oh yeah,
burger sandwiches, salads, you know.
Yes, burgers and wings and stuff like that. It was typical sports bar food. It wasn't anything fancy like the Lost and Found was.
Now the clientele at Nellie's, does that tend to skew in a different range than you would normally see in like a dance bar? Is it a little older, a little bit more professional, or is it just a mixed bag?
It's a mixed bag, and it's mostly around the neighborhood. And one thing that it has become as well, it's not very far from Howard University. And so a lot of the students from Howard make it their bar somewhat on the weekends as well. It's a mixed bag. I can't speak to it now because like I said, I haven't been there in a couple of years. It's a mixed group of people.
I got to ask, because I keep seeing this when I was looking up information on Nelly's. And Nelly's is still operating, by the way, right?
Yeah.
They're still in business. After, when did they open? Do you remember what year they opened, roughly?
They opened in 2007.
So it's been about 15 years. They're mm-hmm. still in business. But mm-hmm. what can you tell me what the story is behind the rubber duck?
Oh, that was...
I have seen rubber ducks in their ads. I've seen rubber ducks in pictures. I've seen rubber ducks everywhere. What the duck?
And I'm looking at two rubber ducks sitting at my desk, up on the shelf above my desk. It was just a gimmick that Doug thought up. Before Doug was owned the bar, he was in promotion and advertising in New York City. So he had a great background in that. And he was very good at coming up with these little off the wall ideas. And the duck was one of them. And he actually found a place and was able to get them branded. He got a little Nelly sticker on the duck's breast, which of course I'm looking at mine right now, right here. And it's pretty much worn off. You can't really see it anymore, but it said right here, it said Nelly's. And of course he's taken a step further since that left. I mean, he has the outside mural with the duck on it. Lisa Marie Thalheimer, who did the Love mural down in Blagden Alley, did that for him. And she's done a number of other things. She's a very nice lesbian artist. And she did the Stoli Harvey Milk label for Stoli when Stoli decided to do that. And that got her involved with Patrick and got her involved with me and stuff like that. So it's amazing how things happen. It's amazing how things come together and how the things that you wouldn't have thought happen. Who would have thought that I would rent a flat from the owner of the largest gay bar in DC? Whoever would have thought that? I lived there with my sister, my brother. It wasn't like I was there with, you know, trying to be a gay person in that place, although I was. But, you know, so who would have thought that that would have ever happened? That would have led all the way up to this conversation today. You know, serendipity is an amazing thing.
And we're so glad it did, because, you know, to be able to capture some of these stories of bars like Lost and Found and the Pier that have been gone for decades, you know, otherwise those stories are going to get lost. And fortunately, through the right connections and perseverance and just dumb luck, you run into people who can share some of those stories with you and fill in the blanks and tell you about the places that, you know, you vaguely remember or that, you know, you never even knew about sometimes.
Yep. It is. And I'm still in contact with some of the people I worked with there, mostly through Facebook. You know.
Well, I welcome you to take a look at our, on our website, we have a page that is tagged TV, like television, mm-hmm. and on the gabearchives.com website. And I've got every single episode that I've done of these interviews so far. There's over 60 of them. And other people from DC, people from New York, from Wisconsin, from San Francisco, LA, Chicago, all over the country, and telling stories about bars from, I think the oldest bar memory that I've had represented so far is 1953 in Nashville, Tennessee.
Really?
Yeah. He was talking, that was his first gay bar. And I think he's like 86 years old now, but he snuck in there when he was like 15 or 16. So.
Oh, that happened a lot.
It did. Well, especially in the gay bars, because the gay bars were, they knew they were a safe haven and they were a little bit less restrictive about a gay person who wanted to come in and be there. And the gays were pretty creative about finding fake IDs. So.
Oh yeah. And the thing was that at least when I first started the Lost and Found, and before that in DC, if you were 18, you could drink beer and wine. You had to be 21 to drink liquor. And so had a mixed clientele, and we had a lot of younger people as a result of that. BC later on changed that and just made it 21 for everything, which everybody got pissed off about. That was in probably the middle 80s.
Yeah.
And yeah, and all these poor college kids, you know. Well, if they were 18 by a certain age, they were grandfathered, which is a weird thing to say for somebody who's 18 that you're grandfathered.
I know, right?
But it in fact was the case. In fact, the person I was seeing at the time was in the 18 year age group. So.
Those were the days.
Those were the days, and we had working the door at the Lost and Found. We had this 5'2" both ways dyke who was really the butchest thing you ever want to see in your life. Her name was Patty Sue Anderson. She is since deceased, but she was hard, tough as nails on people with IDs, and she was really good at spotting bad ones. She was really good.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time out of your day today to share some stories from your past and talk about Lost and Found, The Pier, and Nellie's. And we hope you enjoyed this little trip down memory lane.
Yeah, well, you know, it's great that I was able to share something, and I hope people appreciate the stories that you're doing of putting up this stuff, because it should not be forgotten, all this stuff that went on in the past, because a lot of it just shaped how we are today. You know, I can remember going to the Stonewall. I can remember, you know, being there right after the riots. I can remember the marches on Washington and stuff like that. And people shouldn't forget about that stuff, because if we didn't have that stuff, we wouldn't have the stuff we have today. And the people that they say, oh, well, she's just an old queen. Well, you know, that old queen worked really hard so you could be a young queen. And I think people need to keep that perspective going on. And I think doing this kind of thing that you're doing is a good thing for that.
Thank you. That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show. For more information about this episode, or to find more episodes,